case on our calendar is 98 Home Builders Association of Dayton and the Miami Valley versus the City of Beaver Creek. Mr. Wallach.
I'd like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal, counsel. We are not here this morning to argue the legality of impact fees in general, because all of the parties to this litigation and both of the courts below that have considered the question have concluded that impact fees are something that Ohio municipalities can lawfully promulgate. Rather, we are here this morning to contest the improper invasion of the authority of two different governmental bodies. First, the decision of the Court of Appeals improperly invaded the proper scope of legislative authority of the Beaver Creek City Council. And second, the decision of the Court of Appeals improperly invaded the scope of the trial court's proper authority. The impact fee adopted by the City of Beaver Creek, and which is at issue in this litigation, was entitled to a strong presumption of validity under the rule of Hudson versus Albright, and must be upheld if the validity of the ordinance is even fairly debatable. Under the decision of this court in Willock versus Village of Beechwood, courts are without power to interfere with municipal legislative decisions regarding land use and traffic unless the power of the municipality has been exercised in an arbitrary, confiscatory, and unreasonable manner. Or as stated in State X Rel Gordon v. Rhodes, legislative determination regarding improvements and expenditures will not be rejected or reversed by the court unless manifestly arbitrary or unreasonable. Despite these rules, which have been often repeated and expanded upon by this court and followed carefully by the trial court in this case, the Court of Appeals utterly failed to show any deference to the legislative judgments of the City of Beaver Creek, overruling the decisions of the legislative branch of Beaver Creek on such issues as whether sidewalks are a necessary component of a modern road system, whether storm sewers contribute to the effectiveness of a roadway, and when is it appropriate for a city to contribute its share of the costs of construction, predetermined share of the costs of construction, for a long-range public highway improvement program. This last point was the precise issue on which the Court of Appeals initially overruled the validity of Beaver Creek's impact fee ordinance, apparently convinced that since no schedule had been adopted in the legislation for Beaver Creek to make its contributions to the highway construction program to be partially financed by impact fees, that there was no proof that Beaver Creek would ever make its contribution.
Yeah, well, yeah, no schedule, but more importantly, nothing in any written document that obligates Beaver Creek to pay anything. Isn't that right?
Your Honor, we believe there are at least three different ways in which the ordinance and the documents incorporated by reference in the ordinance specifically obligated the City of Beaver Creek to make its contribution in a predetermined amount. First, let me just review quickly what the capital program here involved. It involved constructing a number of highway improvements over an unknown period of years to be triggered by development as it occurs in the City of Beaver Creek's impact fee district.
I know you're going to go through the three exceptions that are in that ordinance, and I understand that, and I'll give you a chance to do it in a second. I just want to know, do you accept, and I was surprised to see, it seems to me you do accept that the city has to contribute to this.
No question that we accept that, Charlie.
Why?
Because the city calculated on the basis of the best engineering advice that it could procure.
Yes.
The percentage of the traffic that would be generated by new development, as opposed to the percentage that would be generated by all development, whether or not in the Beaver Creek impact fee district.
I understand that, but that's true of every street in every subdivision.
Yes.
And normally, the developer pays for the, not through use fees, of course, but through the construction costs. I guess my concern is, because we always did it too, and I wonder if you do it, do you say in large developments that also the developer has to set aside 5 acres for a park?
Your Honor, in Beaver Creek, before the passage of this ordinance, it was the custom, as it is in many municipalities, to work out ad hoc arrangements with developers.
Sure.
To pay for the construction or portions of the construction of specific improvements. The reason for adopting this ordinance was to cease that ad hoc practice and try and adopt a system that would be fairer to the residents, to the developers, and that would be more efficient in constructing improvements that in some cases are going to be quite extensive and expensive.
Okay.
In particular, there's a bridge that needs to be widened.
Okay, let's just stay with this point, and then you can get to yours and the Chief Justice's point about, because I think it's important, what law is there that says that you have to, city has to contribute a percentage to the use fee?
Your Honor, we interpret this court's holding in the town properties case.
It comes from this court's decision, doesn't
it? Yes, indeed.
So it's judicially created.
Well,
There's no statute that I know about that says that, is there?
There is no statute that...
Nothing in the Constitution that requires it.
Well, except insofar as this court's ruling incorporates the Constitution.
Okay.
Beaver Creek intended to be fair to all of the parties here, and in particular, it intended to avoid the situation where one developer would be saddled with extraordinary costs to build, say, a $2.2 million bridge widening project, when that development may not be responsible for the entire demand increase that leads the bridge to be widened. So the program was established to try and estimate what the Beaver Creek would look like when it was fully developed, how much of a road system it would need to handle that traffic. Beaver Creek intended to be fair to all of the parties here, and in particular, it intended to avoid the situation where one developer would be saddled with extraordinary costs to build, say, a $2.2 million bridge widening project, when that development may not be responsible for the entire demand increase that leads the bridge to be widened. So the program was established to try and estimate what the Beaver Creek would look like when it was fully developed, how much of a road system it would need to handle that traffic, and what percentage of that increased traffic could be properly assigned to new development inside Beaver Creek as opposed to in the surrounding areas. And only that portion of the cost was apportioned through the impact fee system to new development, and was then apportioned on a unit basis, based on units of either residential property or 1,000 square foot units of commercial or office property.
Yes, Mr. Wallach, as you know, the appellee, and I thought the court of appeals referred to it, that the Department of Highway, or the High Department of Highways did not concur in the survey that was done about the traffic. What's your response to that? Is that significant or?
No, Your Honor, it's a very small point. There was one traffic projection that the Highway Department disagreed with. It's a projection. People make projections. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. The Highway Department had its opinion about it. But it was a very little relevance to the entire program. This is a program that's going to take decades to complete. And there's opportunities for revision of the plan every 2 years. And in fact, the plan was revised at the two-year interval as required by the ordinance to try and keep up to date on what is actually happening, both in terms of construction costs, in terms of development, and in terms of how development is occurring, because all that you can do when you're looking that far in the future is to try to project. And no one had any confidence that you can project precisely 25 or 35 years in the future, which is what it may very well take before Beaver Creek is fully built out in the impact fee district. So the fact that a particular projection may have been a source of disagreement with the Highway Department, I regard as a relatively small point.
I had just one other question, and maybe it's not terribly relative, but you make the argument, Beaver Creek makes the argument that, well, there's all this development and so forth, and we're growing, but Beaver Creek really has the authority, the power to control that development, don't they? And isn't that sort of a bootstrap argument that we need to build the roads and we can't really predict how much, what the vastness of them, but they can really control that if they want to, can't they?
Well, Your Honor, only to a certain extent. This is not a situation, as in the previous case, where you're building new roads into an area that's undeveloped. This is a case where you have a road system, a highway system already in place in a city that already has substantial population, where the demands that are going to be imposed on it by the new development on the already existing streets are going to make those streets intolerable. The city right now has a level of service rated at C, which is a tolerable level of service, not great, but tolerable. And merely to maintain that level of service C as the population and as the commercial growth of the city expands, It's going to be necessary to widen the roads, add turning lanes to the roads, widen a bridge, not to build new roads into undeveloped territory, but simply to keep the roads from becoming so congested as development occurs, that the city can't tolerate that, and the people won't want to come and shop there or live there. Can the city control that development? Well, if people are applying for permits to use their land in ways for which the land is properly zoned, the city has a very limited ability to tell them not to use it. And this is already land that has been made the subject of a planning process and is the subject of a comprehensive plan that sets forth what are the appropriate uses. And the projections that the city used to devise the impact fee were based upon the assumption that the land would someday be fully developed according to the comprehensive plan that the city had adopted. So I guess I don't think the city can do a whole lot to prevent people from developing their property in accordance with the zoning that is presently on the property. Now, if someone wants to change the zoning and increase the density, for example, the city might have more control in that case.
Do you accept the proposition, or what is your position on the proposition that Town Properties, Inc., the Fairfield case, does mandate an impact fee ordinance that has a matching funds provision? The trial court found that that case didn't control that, didn't they?
Your Honor, we believe that...
It seems to me you're conceding it.
We believe it's an overly simplistic reading of Town Properties. The way we read Town Properties, it requires that you require the people paying the fee or the development tax, as it's referred to in that case, pay only their fair share of the cost. That you can't impose all of the cost of a project on new development when new development isn't responsible for all of that cost. That would be unfair and discriminatory. But the idea that it has to be an annual 50-50 matching contribution, I think is more an accident of the language that got used in the Whitten case than anything that's present in Town Properties. And we certainly don't concede that an annual 50-50 matching contribution is required by Town Properties.
Sounds like to me you're conceding the trial court, at least on that issue, was wrong.
No, I don't think the trial court believed that a 50-50 annual contribution was required.
I thought the trial court...
The Court of Appeals seems to have taken that position.
But I thought the trial court held that it did not mandate that an impact fee ordinance must have a matching funds provision.
Well, again, Your Honor, that's the question, what does matching funds provision mean? If matching funds means 50-50 annual contribution, then we agree with the trial court it does not mandate that. If it means that you must make sure in setting up your development tax that you aren't taxing people unfairly for costs that they're not responsible for, that's what I think Town Properties stands for.
Of course, here the Court of Appeals seems, I mean, we have a somewhat easier issue because the Court of Appeals takes the position that the city of Beaver Creek was obliged to contribute nothing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And that, I guess, is the part of the case where maybe a lot of this hinges. Tax versus fee still gets down to whether or not the city was obliged to contribute. In whatever percentage, and the Court of Appeals says zero. Your argument is, as we reduced, you know, we factored in, and the factoring in to reduce the impact fees is our contribution.
Your Honor, no. It's more than that. That's certainly one of the indices here that the city intends to contribute. The city says in the ordinance that it intends to tax new development only for its reasonable share of the cost. So that's a specific statement in the ordinance. The city says in the ordinance and in the report of Flynn Plowmeyer that's incorporated into the ordinance that it intends to finance a good percentage of these projects through issuing bonds, which is, of course, the only practical way that large public works projects can normally be financed, through the sale of bonds. If the city sells bonds, the city will have entered into a binding contract with the bondholders.
This is important and pointed that you refer to all this in the future tense.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not because the point the Court of Appeals is struggling with is there's no obligation, no written obligation to do this in the future.
If there were a written statement in the ordinance that says we will contribute our fair share, that could be amended or repealed by the next day by the city council. It wouldn't bind anybody because a municipal ordinance isn't a contract. Mm-hmm. And what the appellees and what the Court of Appeals have fastened onto is the fact that, well, how do you obligate someone to put it in? If you have the kind of program, as in the Town case, where you're simply charging a fee to put it into a fund to use for recreation, and there's no fixed amount you need at any given time, then it would be fairly simple to do just that and say, okay, the city's going to contribute $100,000 every year to this fund. But that wouldn't meet the fund flow needs of the projects. It would be nice from a very simple legalistic standpoint, but it wouldn't be practical from a municipal finance point, because when the city sells the bonds, it's going to have to raise the money from some source or other to pay those bondholders, because it's under an enforceable indenture that this court will enforce. And until that happens, there really isn't anything enforceable that the city could do to obligate itself to contribute funds, other than make contributions, which it has done, and which it intends to do, and which we have said both at the trial court and the Court of Appeals level, we judicially acknowledge we are bound to do.
Okay, on that point, Mr. Wallach, may I press you a little further, please, on the Town case? Because I don't read Town that way, and I'll ask them that too, but it seems to me in Town, the ordinance of the city did provide that something should come out of the city's general fund. The court didn't require that in Town. It just found that that was in the ordinance already, didn't it?
I agree.
All right. Well, it seems to me you're arguing that you're bound by the Town case, which says you have to contribute something. They just found that that's what the ordinance did, and therefore it didn't violate equal protection.
Yes. I think that's true.
All right. So if that's true, then it can't be, then there is no judicially created or statutorily created doctrine that there must be a corresponding, whatever it be, equal or percentage of the total amount of the assessment with regard to user fee.
I agree with you, right? It depends very much on the facts of the ordinance and how it works and what it's paying for, and to evaluate what is fair.
Okay, now is there any law anyplace that says the city is required to contribute a fair share, let's call it that, a fair share, you like those words, I know, from the bargaining contracts, the fair share agreement, is there any requirement any place that the city has to contribute a fair share?
Your Honor, only to the extent that the requirements of equal protection would require it. That would again depend on the facts of the particular ordinance.
Should we use this case to make that clear?
Your Honor, that would certainly be one thing that could be accomplished in this case. I mean, for example, I don't believe the city was compelled in calculating the funds to be provided by the city in this impact fee program to include the $6.6 million in federal and state funds, which were given as a credit against the ultimate cost of the project. I don't know if the city was required to do that. The city did that because it was attempting to be fair. You could make a better argument if you were the developers who were objecting to paying the fees, that the fee was unfair if it didn't give some credit to the amount of new development outside the city that created the demand for greater traffic facilities inside the city. So I think probably those two could be treated somewhat differently in that respect.
This case was decided on summary judgment and at the lower court, wasn't... Oh, no, you had a trial. You had a trial on that. Yeah.
And then 10 days of trial spread over a period
but
of months.
The summary was on which issue?
Well, the summary was on some of the state law issues,
right,
as to whether there was power of the city to adopt an impact fee, which was still being challenged at that stage of the proceedings, even though that was not challenged at the Court of Appeals level. The federal issues of equal protection.
You're satisfied with the issues that were decided on summary judgment? Should they be, I mean, were they properly decided on that?
We believe they were, Your Honor, yes. Our complaint is not with the trial court. Our complaint is with the Court of Appeals, which not only went way beyond showing any deference to the city's legislative determinations, but showed no deference whatever to the factual findings of the trial court. To find a Court of Appeals decision that's 124 pages long, most of which picks over items in the record and misinterprets many of them because, of course, they weren't briefed or argued to it, is almost a litmus test, as far as I'm concerned, that the Court of Appeals had misconstrued its role rather radically. Instead of reviewing the application of the law by the trial court, the Court of Appeals decided to go back and review every one of the factual determinations that the trial court either ruled on or decided they didn't have to rule on because it was within the city's legislative purview.
Well, some of those issues were on manifest weight. I mean, there is a legitimate role for a court of appeals with regard to assessing the factual support for the judgment.
Certainly, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. But I think that the legitimate role was far exceeded here.
If we accept what I think I hear you saying, that to meet equal protection proposition, that there has to be some contribution, wouldn't that make us or some court then have to decide in every case what is reasonable, what is substantial, what is adequate, what is, in every individual case, there'd be no law?
No, Your Honor, it's our belief that that's a decision that's to be made by the legislative body and only reviewed to the extent it reaches abuse of discretion standards by the courts.
Okay, but what if the legislative body says there will be no matching contribution?
In an appropriate case, that might be a very good decision, because there might be very well be a case where 100% of the cost is attributable to new development, in which case it would be inappropriate.
Okay, so that still leaves us with having to review every individual case on its facts, if somebody objects.
Your Honor, I think that's always the case.
No, it isn't.
In public law, that if someone objects and brings a lawsuit, somebody in the court system has to review it.
Well, I agree, but at least you have guidelines to know whether or not the lawsuit is going to be valid or not.
Well, and here the guidelines, I believe, are that it's within the sound discretion of the legislature unless it approaches abuse of discretion.
Thank you, Mr. Wallach. Mr. McAmey.
It because this is not just a little about little or Beaver Creek. This is in every subdivision from now on that is going to be constructed in the state. And in past practice too, because we used to do this all the time, and the builders that I represented always complained about it. And yet we just allocated it back to the individual lots, don't we, and then collect it from at the sale.
That's right, Your Honor, although I'd like to make the distinction. Although this case is being closely watched, we submit that it's not necessarily, from a discretionary appeal standpoint, of great public importance. We submit that the authority set forth by this court in Town and Whitten and partially in Westlake adequately address the issues.
What language in Town? What language in Town do you say mandates a contribution? Let's call it that. Rather than a fair share, what language in Town mandates a contribution by the political subdivision if you assess a user fee?
Your Honor, I would go to the end of the decision where it talks about the equal protection provisions of the Constitution.
Yes, sir.
Do not require that the state to maintain a rigid rule of taxation. And then it goes on from
Well, let's go on. Or, in effect, to resort to close distinctions or to maintain a precise scientific uniformity and possible differences in tax burdens not shown to be substantial or which are based on discretion, not shown to be arbitrary or capricious, do not fall within constitutional prohibitions. That's what it says, doesn't it?
That's correct, and we would agree there's no requirement for a strict dollar per dollar. Okay, but there is what I think town and Whitman stand for, the proposition that builders and developers must carry their fair share of water, and the public must carry their fair share of water. And so it's the Constitution, those of equal protection and due process, that require the contribution. And that's where the Beaver Creek Ordinance totally fails. And that's where this ordinance went astray from the very beginning. You can search the four corners of the document. There's not one provision in that document that requires the city to make the first contribution for the construction of impact fee improvements. Now, the provision cited by Mr. Wallach, I'll tip my hand to him, they're creative, but they don't require a contribution. For example, if you look at the purpose clause of the ordinance itself. Now, the purpose section cited in the brief, it only states that it assures that the developer will bear their proportionate share. And then you have to go to the implication, well, here goes, the city must therefore bear their proportionate share. Let's look at the other red herring that's submitted in terms of contributions by the city. If you look at the prescriptive reductions and the credit reductions, now, sure, those are reductions, but if you look at the analysis done by the Court of Appeals, from the very beginning, they overstated the cost of these improvements. So it's a reduction from a set of improvements that have been overstated. And the reductions still don't require the city to put that first dollar on the table to pay for any impact of the improvements. And if you look at what happened during the trial, it's exactly what happened. $2 million of impact fees collected. All of the money from developers, all of the money were expended. That insult injury, $200,000 of those funds, paid the lawyers for the city of Beaver Creek in defending that this litigation, this ordinance.
But as Mr. Wallach points out, when I asked him about that subject, he points out that the ordinance, even if it were in there, it's not the same. How does it oblige? It's not a contract to pay. How would it could be amended, you know, in the future? So he points out he doesn't think that's all that key.
Oh, I think it's critical, Your Honor, because otherwise you're going to, the end result is going to be developers are going to pay the entire cost of all of the improvements. And you're going to require developers, absent any specific requirement in the ordinance, developers to be the watchdog, continually watching whether the city makes its fair share. And as I was stating, during the $2 million expenditure, the city only contributed $25,000 for an engineering study in the impact fee district. If you look at the testimony elicited from the law director, David Eubank, the city manager, Steve Stapleton, finance director, Mr. Stoops, all of those folks testified at trial, yes, this ordinance does not require us to make a contribution, but our intentions are good.
So I'm interested in your statements that everybody's watching this case because it's so important to the government all over the state and what we've done. Stipulations here from you all agree that impact fees are constitutional in the state of Ohio. They may not be common yet, but they're common in some other states, high growth states. They're obviously coming to our part of the world, particularly where there's a lot of growth. You agree that's constitutional and local governments can do that.
As long as the ordinances are structured to ensure that there's proportionate sharing of the expense of the development and that there's a direct relationship.
He seems to agree that the local community has to bear its fair share.
The case doesn't say that the local community has to bear its fair share.
What's there left to argue about if people want it? I mean, if that's the law, if it's constitutional to have impact fees, and if impact fees are only going to, in application, pass a constitutional muster if the local community makes its fair share of contributions, then you've stipulated everything that you're supposed to hear argued.
Yes, I think I understand the question. The only thing we're arguing about is the city required to make a contribution, and we submit clearly not. The reason why it's being closely watched under the answer.
You mean in this case?
In this case, okay. Couple of reasons. This is the first time before this court an impact fee for major capital improvement projects in Ohio municipality has appeared before the court. Prior, it's been a sanitary sewer system, and that was since decidedly the Amber's case under Clean Air Power Constitution. And it's been park district fees, but this is the first real major capital improvement project regarding an impact fee. And Ohio is one of many states that do not have enabling legislation that sets forth the standards by which impact fees are to be implemented. And the appellate court decision was one of the first decisions in Ohio that very scholarly, very thoroughly synthesized existing Ohio Supreme Court law on the issue of impact fees.
But it seemed to conclude that there was an important difference between whether we call this an impact fee or a tax. Does it make any difference? Is that just a way of getting to the standard?
I think the initial inquiry must be whether it's a fee or whether it's a tax. If it's a tax, then you go down the path of has there been an equal contribution made? If it's a fee, then you go down the path of is there a reasonable connection between the need for the improvement caused by the development, and is that improvement, does that directly benefit the developer himself, the dual rational nexus test? With that, I conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McNamee. Mr. Shuck.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, good morning. You know, I represent the interests of some parties that own commercial development property in the city of Beaver Creek, whose ability to develop that property or to sell it to other developers was frustrated by the imposition of the ordinance. I would like to start by following up on an observation that you made, Justice, which is that it posits a question: have not the important issues that this case would appear to present have been stipulated by counsel? I think in large part they have. I would submit to the court that this case now is about the facts of this case. It is about how this particular impact fee ordinance operates and how it has been implemented.
Well, is an issue of law for us to decide whether a city or municipality's contribution to the cost of these sorts of improvements has to be in writing? That'd be a legal issue. Mm-hmm.
Would you, Your Honor, you say in writing. I think that I would put the question to Your Honor as follows. I think that the issue presented in that respect is, must the enactment reflect a fair or proportionate allocation of the cost of the improvements at issue between the various sectors of the community, only one of which is the developer?
And by enactment, you mean ordinance or whatever?
Yes, Your Honor. And in that respect, this case presents an issue that, to my knowledge, was not presented by town or by Witten, because in those instances, the court dealt with the four corners of this ordinance. I think the court can deal with the four corners of this ordinance as well, because it cannot, in my view, be fairly asserted that this ordinance imposes any requirement on the city of Beaver Creek to expend any particular monies from any particular source at any particular time to construct any particular improvements. The only requirement pertinent to this discussion that can be found in the ordinance, in my view, is that if the improvements are eventually built, and it could be out into the middle of the next century, they must be built in the impact fee district, but there is no requirement that they must benefit the property burdened by the exaction. Let me give you an example. Mr. Wallach suggested that it is the city's intent, not expressed anywhere, to float bonds to pay for the city's share, self-proclaimed share of the expenses at issue. I would point out, first of all, that based on the record, the city hasn't done that. The city, in fact, came up with only a minuscule portion of what it declared to be its share. But in fact, the introduction to the Flume, Klausmeier, and Garam report, which is the underpinning of the ordinance, found in appendix page 243, states, and I quote, "Using the impact fee legislation, the city will retire the bonds by charging developers impact fees," close quote. So it is misleading to assert that the city is going to come up through this other funding mechanism with its share of the expenses, when the experts said, well, if you want to float bonds to advance your share of the expenses, you can recover that share ultimately from the developers as well. And the record shows that in effect is what has happened here. The record shows that in the time between the enactment of the ordinance and the time of trial, approximately a year, year and a half ago, while the city had collected and spent approximately $2 million in impact fees, it had spent or budgeted at most $150,000 of its own funds and no funds from other sources on traffic system improvements in the impact fee district. As a result, developers paid for more than 93% of the traffic system improvements over the years during which the ordinance has been in effect, that is prior to trial. Not 58%, more than 93%. Mr. Beach, the city engineer, developed a five-year capital improvement plan running out through 2000, which he submitted to the Ohio Public Works Commission. Only two of the many projects scheduled to receive funding from impact fees were to be financed with funds other than impact fees. The total cost of projects to be financed in whole by impact fees is in excess of $6 million during that period. That is entirely by impact fees collected from developers, while the cost of those to be financed by a combination of impact fees and federal highway funds is only $760,000. There's no breakdown with respect to the $760,000 as to what portion of that is impact fees. The necessary inference from this evidence, I submit, is that there is no commitment by the city and possibly no ability by the city, evident on this record, for the city to come up with what it has declared itself to be its fair share.
Do your clients agree that they should be responsible for the total cost of the construction that relates to new development, and their concern is that there's no way to determine whether they're paying only for new development and improvement roads, as Wallach says, in existing areas? Is that your interest?
I would agree, Your Honor, that my client, the developer, should pay for the new development, the cost of new development that developer does. That is your classic PUD style of development. That's what the city did before they developed this scheme.
They don't argue at all that the city ought to pay a part of that. Is that right?
Not if it is directly attributable to their development. That, as I say, is standard PUD. It's been done that way in this state for years and years, quite successfully. The facts of this case, to highlight, Your Honor, the issue that Your Honor's question raises, my clients own some property on the west side of Beaver Creek near what's called Colonel Glenn Highway, out near Interstate 675, which is the loop that gets you around the east side of Dayton. And the only development, the only capital improvements that the city foresaw around that property, for which they wanted to impose impact fees, was to build a bridge over it. They weren't going to do anything to improve the roads that fed that property. They were going to channel traffic over it, which many commercial developers would find to be disadvantageous, depending on what use you make of the property. One of the problems here is that there's no connector between the funds being raised from any particular developer and how or when those funds will ever be used, if used. For example, the funds, rather than be segregated, have been placed in the city's general fund. The interest on the funds collected is being used in the general fund. It's not being used for capital improvements, for roadways, in the impact fee district.
But to be fair about it, the ordinance does say that it's only supposed to be used in the area for which is affected.
You're right, Your Honor, and it refers to a trust fund. There is no trust fund.
And then how do you get to the next point? I guess that I want to go back to the Chief Justice's question. Do you want us to specifically say that in any one of these ordinances, there has to be a written assertion that the municipality, the subdivision, is going to be responsible for some matching share determined on actuarially and how much it is? Does it have to be in writing? Because here, they figured out what it was and then deducted $6,600,000 on the basis that you wouldn't have to pay that. Isn't that a contribution by the city?
Your Honor, let me answer your question in two ways, if I may. And first, let me meet directly the thrust of your question. I think what you're asking me is it our position that in order for impact fees to be constitutional in this state, the enabling legislation must specifically spell out the funding scheme? I think that's what you're asking. And my answer is that where the legislature has made a determination based upon expertise, as in this case, that the Constitution requires some allocation among different interests, it must then provide a mechanism to see that that predetermined allocation is satisfied. So to the extent, are you asking me, must it be in writing? Certainly it must be.
Obviously, it has to be with that proposition.
But I would, if I may, Your Honor, I would answer your question personally in a little different way, and it is this. I think that the rule of law that should govern this case is found in Town and Witten, and by implication in the Court of Appeals decision in Westlake, which this court declined to review. I don't think this court needs to write on this case to establish what I believe the governing legal principle is. I think this case can be decided on its own facts. I do not believe that this case presents the constitutional question that at first blush it might appear to present. And one option, of course, that this court has is not to write on the merits of this case, but to allow this case to fall within what is not debated Supreme Court principle in this state consistent with the law elsewhere. And I think I would disagree with Mr. McAfee that this is a seminal case because I think the implementation of this ordinance is so troubling. I must say I have never been in an argument in any court before where I heard a lawyer criticize a reviewing court for being too thorough. It is a novel approach for me. And one can debate that. Of course, the premise of the Court of Appeals opinion on page 41 was, at the outset, we emphasized the presumption of constitutionality of the regulation and so on and so forth. So to say that the Court of Appeals took too close a look at the record in this case, I think demonstrates what for me is troubling about this case, namely that I don't think that it genuinely raises a constitutional issue that this court must of necessity write on to decide,
But don't you think it would be helpful if we set forth the elements that are necessary in such legislation? We specifically said that the funds should be segregated rather than being put in the general fund, et cetera, et cetera.
I can't argue with that proposition, Your Honor.
We have not said that, I don't think, in any other case. We have not laid it out specifically.
You have not. In Town, as Justice Douglas aptly points out, what the court said is, you have done it right here. And what you're saying is, but should we not speak to the obverse of that? Certainly that would be helpful. My question is this the case in which to make that law? Because this is so record-driven.
Well, let me still kind of make sure that we've got the issue as narrow as we can make it. If Beaver Creek had made all the contributions that you wish the city had made, absent any language in the ordinance that required them to do that, would there be an issue?
There would be this issue, Your Honor. And I appreciate my time has expired, so I will answer your question and then cease. There would be this issue. There is no obligation in this ordinance to build any particular roads or to build any poor improvements or to do it with any particular in any particular period of time. Full build-out is estimated out to the middle of the next century. It's premised on traffic counts that the Ohio Department of Transportation refused to certify because they considered them to be excessive. One of the premises under the study for the construction to be done is to build curbs and sewers, curbs and gutters and sidewalks on existing streets that do not exist. In other words, to raise the level of service on these existing streets, not to maintain it, but to raise it. So to answer your Honor's question simply, there are a number of pernicious aspects of this legislation which would exist notwithstanding the city's actual commitment to what it purports to say that it will do, the bottom line of which is, if it is a fair constitutional principle that to burden property, there must be some proportionate benefit conferred on the property burden to justify the exaction, well, this ordinance doesn't.
And that was the reason for my question. The Constitution, if we're using equal protection, doesn't require that the rights guaranteed by equal protection are in writing. We look at conduct, do we not? And Tim, that's the, at least the implication of the appellant's argument is that this doesn't need to be in writing. Even if it wasn't an ordinance, the ordinance can be changed. And so you look at, I guess you look at good faith of the city to conduct itself in a way that it knows it has to conduct itself.
I can't argue with that, Your Honor. My only response must be that the conduct of the city, according to the record, has been such that the developers should not expect the city to come up with their 42%. Thank you. Well, thank you for your additional time.
Thank you, Mr. Shuck. Mr. Wallach, you've used your time, but it may take a minute.
First, let me read you the sentence that Mr. Shuck left out when he read you a portion from the Klausmeier report. It first says, essentially, this legislation will enable the city to pass a bond issue to finance the planned improvements in a rational and orderly way over the next several years. That's the one he left out.
So how are you able to pass a bond issue if you don't segregate the funds?
Your Honor, these funds are segregated in a separate account. The lack of understanding of municipal finance demonstrated by the appellee and by the Court of Appeals is staggering. But there was testimony absolutely clear on the record that these funds are segregated in a separate account and have been since day one.
The ordinance requires it.
It requires it, and the testimony is that it was done. What the appellees seem to be confused about is the difference between what bank account you keep it in and whether it is segregated into a separate fund for municipal accounting purposes. And no amount of explanation seems to be able to dispel that. One thing I'd like to speak to, if I can just have a moment, is the question of the conduct of the city that Mr. Shuck was making such a great show of at the end. The conduct of the city here has been largely driven by Mr. Shuck and his clients and the litigation that they have brought. The city is not able to sell bonds and to use the funds for development while this litigation is pending. And in fact, I have another client that has passed an impact fee that has been challenged that has had precisely the same problem. When they attempted to go to market with their bonds, they were told, no one will buy your bonds. Why, you have a lawsuit pending. So it is not surprising that during the pendency of this litigation, the city has been unable to sell the bonds and raise the money that it intends to use as its major contribution towards this construction program. The reverse bootstrapping of suing the city and then saying, because we sued you, you can't sell bonds, and therefore you haven't sold bonds, so you aren't doing what you're supposed to do, is rather extreme here. What the court should look at, I believe, is the face of the ordinance as supplemented by the Klausmeier report that's incorporated into it to determine if the ordinance is constitutional and to judge what the city's conduct has been in essentially a war environment ever since the ordinance was passed will not be a very good way of indexing or predicting the city's conduct in the future. The way to compel a city to comply with its legal obligations is through a writ of mandamus. That has always been the case. If any of the appellees feel that the city is not carrying out its obligations as set forth in the ordinance, they know how to file for the mandate.
Thank you, Mr. Waller. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.